Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Dr. Joseph Parker. Dr. Parker's journey began with 4 years of dedicated service in the U.S. Marine Corps, where he earned accolades such as the Meritorious Unit Citation and Good Conduct Medal. His exceptional dedication led to acceptance into the U.S. Air Force Officer Training School and a subsequent role as a Minuteman II ICBM commander within U.S. Space Command, earning further recognition, including Presidential Unit Citation, National Defense Service Medal, and the Air Force Achievement Medal. And if that wasn't enough, he then transitioned into the medical field. Dr. Parker pursued studies at Mayo Medical School and joined the U.S. Medical Corps, ultimately achieving the rank of captain. Specializing in emergency medicine, he served as director of emergency medicine at two hospitals and founded an emergency medicine contracting company to save a foundering hospital from closure. He now speaks out as an advocate for physicians and patients and embodies a rare blend of scientific expertise, military leadership, and medical acumen, contributing significantly to the advancement of space exploration and the betterment of human health and safety. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Parker.
Thank you very much.
Your achievements are incredible, but your story, arguably, is even more incredible. So to begin, can you tell the audience how we met and your journey from where you were before to where you now find yourself?
Sure. This is a very unique time in American history. I say that even though there is a parallel going back to about 1915. But for the most part, physicians are allowed to practice medicine divorced from concerns of politics or and there is a respect, a deference that is usually offered to physicians by law enforcement that physicians will not be prosecuted if they practice medicine in a manner not consistent with that law enforcement officer's personal beliefs. And that has held, you know, pretty true. There was one era in history when it was not. That was about 1915. A law was passed that ended up with about 10,000 doctors being prosecuted and many of them going to prison. And then the Supreme Court said, no, the federal government cannot dictate the practice of medicine. That's left to the states. And that stood until the Controlled Substances Act. But even after the Controlled Substances Act, it's only been since about 2018 that the DEA has decided that targeting physicians will, I hate to say it, it's almost a form of legal terrorism. You take one physician and you roast him publicly or her, and that warns everybody else, right? In the military, we used to refer to something called a Russian warning shot. That's when the Russians shoot the first guy and that warns all the rest. So that's kind of what they're doing. They're not publicizing what will get you targeted or what will get you locked up. They're keeping all that secret, and they're using proprietary secret algorithms that we don't know. And so just like the pharmacist, we don't know when we trigger some algorithm that says that's outside the usual practice, right? And physicians are being locked up all over the country. And now fewer will be locked up now because most are just not treating pain with controlled medications at all. And I think that's the DEA's goal.
Certainly that can be a very substantiated argument. What I found very fascinating about what you just said was the analogy with military and control. And being someone from the armed services, you have a unique perspective. What analogies or what historical comparables can you cite besides some of the previous eras in U.S. history, like with the Harrison Narcotic Act and now with the Controlled Substance Act? From a military standpoint, what are some comparables that you can make with the federal government strategy against physicians?
There's a very important parallel that can be drawn. In the United States military, when you are a military physician, you are in the military. However, you do not take a direct role in combat, right? You're not out there in your white coat shooting at the enemy. You might have a pistol to defend yourself if they overrun the base, that you're not out there engaging in combat, and that gives you special protections. It also gives you special obligations. A military physician is obligated to treat the most severely injured person who has a chance of survival, regardless of which side they fought for. Now, that's hard for a lot of people to understand, but if they bring you 3 Al-Qaeda fighters and 3 Marines, U.S. Marines, and I was a U.S. Marine for the Air Force, so I've got a soft spot for Marines. You have to look and see which person needs and can benefit from my intervention first. And that is a requirement that's there for a reason, because as a physician on the battlefield, if we start deciding who gets to live and who gets to die based on the color of their uniform, our enemies will do the same. Now, some of them still do, and it's argued that, well, they do it to us exactly, and that's why we should not do it to them, unless we want to be indistinguishable from them, right? So there is a mission creep that occurs in military confrontations. Sometimes when you're fighting an enemy, you start adopting their tactics, and this is one tactic that we cannot adopt. And there were a lot of Japanese and German doctors who ended up on the wrong end of the gallows because of their conduct. There were many more that probably should have been that were not, though I'm not greatly in favor of capital punishment, because it's so easy for our Justice Department to get it wrong, and it's impossible to go back and correct once you've you have capital punishment, of course. But as a Marine, of course, I was willing to fight for my country. As a physician, it's a totally different obligation. But we have that same obligation to our patients today. A patient comes to us. Let's say they come to us on seeing another physician. They're on high-dose opiates, let's say 270 morphine dose equivalents. And they're already on a benzodiazepine, maybe even 2, as one of my patients came in on. So a patient comes to you on 270 morphine dose equivalents. He's already on 40 milligrams of diazepam a day. He's taking 2 milligrams of Xanax up to 3 times a day as needed. What do you do? Well, the DEA would say, cut it down to 90 morphine dose equivalents and stop those benzodiazepines, because we see this warning letter that he got. Right? His doctor got a warning letter saying, be cautious using these together. It doesn't say don't use these together. It says be cautious. But when you don't stop the benzodiazepines, they will argue that you ignored the risk to his health. The risk of overdose or addiction was ignored because you did not stop them. So the only legally safe thing to do is to stop the benzodiazepines immediately, because as soon as you write those two together, you can be prosecuted. But doing so will kill your patient. He will absolutely die. If he's been on 40 milligrams of diazepam for an extended period of time, even a few months, and the patient I'm talking about was on it for 10 years, and you stop it abruptly, he's going to have intractable seizures. All ER doctors know, and most medical students know, you stop benzodiazepines abruptly, you can kill somebody, because the seizures won't stop until they get a shot of Ativan or Valium. If no one's there to do that for them, they will die. So you're facing your patient, and you now have to say to yourself, do I write this prescription knowing that I'm putting myself at great risk of losing my liberty by prosecution and losing my practice and everything else? Even if you're acquitted, you're still completely, almost completely destroyed. If you're convicted, it's a whole new ballgame. You have to decide, just like we did on the battlefield, do I risk my life to do what's right for this patient medically? Or do I do what's safe for me and risk his life? Risk him having a seizure over the next 8 to 12 hours and dying. Well, no one is going to prosecute you for cutting someone off their medications and that person dying. It happens every day. People have heart attacks. They have strokes. There's a common misconception that I had heard in the ER. People don't die from opioid withdrawals. It's absolutely false. That's like saying people don't die from guns. That's true. Very rarely does a gun ever kill anyone. But bullets kill a lot of people. So when it comes to the pain medicines, you put them in severe pain, and the stress can kill them. their blood pressure goes through the roof, putting them at risk of heart attack and stroke. If you had told a doctor during the American Civil War that pain can't kill someone, they would have slapped you, because they knew pain killed patients because they had no anesthetics. So they had to do a limb amputation in about a minute and 40 seconds, or that person would die. From what? And when you did the autopsy, what did they die of? They died of cardiac failure. Their heart gave out. The catecholamines, the stress hormones, were just too much. Patients in severe chronic pain are the same way. They've already got a shortened life, no matter what you do, and then you're going to be blamed for that. So today, you can have a patient stable on their medication for 20 years, and they're 80 years old, and if they die in their sleep, you can be prosecuted. Because the prosecutor can say that your medications contributed to their death, and you can't prove it did not. You're trying to prove a negative. And that's impossible.
That's interesting, because when you talk about decision making, the DEA has somehow become the arbiter of what is morally acceptable, and as a result, what is clinically acceptable. And you phrase it nicely when you made the distinction between legally safe versus clinically safe. And I want to go through that a little bit more. Talk about the inherent contradictions that go through any clinical decision when you have so many outside forces influencing and pressuring you to make certain actions towards a patient.
Sure. We are taught that we should not practice defensive medicine, but we are human beings and we have fears. We fear being targeted civilly by the medical board, by our colleagues, or criminally now. And so in the back of our mind is always a reminder of what's the worst that could happen, right? At the same time, we are under an obligation to first do no harm. So the patient comes to me already on those medications. If I believe that taking him off will harm him, then I am absolutely abrogating my responsibilities as a physician by taking him off, right? Even if they're more than the CDC would recommend, he's already on them, so I'm not starting them. It becomes an impossible question, and it comes down to what can you live with and what is more important to you. Is it more important to you that you be absolutely legally safe? And I can promise you that if you end up being indicted, you will absolutely beat yourself silly forever prescribing anything controlled. And you say to yourself, if I ever make it through this, it'll be ibuprofen and Tylenol and nobody's getting anything. Not because of medicine, but because everything you built has been taken from you. Your retirement is now in your attorney's bank account. I actually have one attorney driving the nice Tesla that I had owned. I'm not an ostentatious person, but I liked Teslas, and I had bought a nice little Tesla. He is running around in that Tesla right now. When we're on the battlefield, we expect to make these decisions, right? You expect to go down for those you care about, for your country, for the right thing. You don't expect that that's going to happen to you in medical practice. You expect to have an opportunity to go in front of the medical board and argue to physicians why you did something. And I did that on these same patients. And the medical board had, as soon as the DEA was looking at me, the medical board did a suspension. I went down and defended myself and was able to, they removed the suspension. I'm returning to practice. But a law enforcement officer got on the news and said the medical board is being too easy on these doctors. Wow. Within a matter of hours, I'm indicted. I'm not the only one, by far. The doctors are being indicted and convicted all over the country. And conviction is so easy because they pay medical experts a tremendous amount of money to make completely biased, unscientific, unverified statements. But the jury doesn't know. You know, you're in front of 12 lay people and they're not physicians. And they don't even understand the words you're using. You know, the words that you're saying are actually Greek and Latin. And it's very unusual for anyone there to be a nurse or to know what's being said. And even then, can they really understand what you were facing when you're trying to treat this patient? Yeah. We can debate whether opiates should have been prescribed at a lower rate in the past. I don't think there's any question that many of us should have been more cautious. That's not criminal. To be trained one way and to practice in the manner that you were trained, and then to have someone redefine, well, what is criminal? I'll give you an example. A recent Freedom of Information Act release showed that they had at first targeted the top 5% of all pain specialists. They then turned that around and targeted the top 20% of all doctors. Well, that and labeled them as overprescribers.
Yeah.
Well, that's every doctor treating chronic pain. Every doctor treating chronic pain, because there's only 4,000 or 5,000 pain specialists in the whole country. So if and they're scanning about 20,000 patients a month. Many groups are doing more. They're using these algorithms to crank through the numbers. The insurance companies have joined with the Office of the Inspector General and the DEA to try to find outliers. Right. But the doctor willing to treat the sickest patients, the doctor willing to treat the patient with cancer, the patient that's on hospice, they're going to be the outlier. And so they are confusing. The DEA is confusing the usual practice of medicine with the average practice of medicine.
Yes. Yes.
Right. The usual practice of medicine says if the doctor saw the patient, examined the patient, and prescribed what they thought was in the best patient's best interest for a condition the doctor believed the patient had, that is the usual practice of medicine, full stop. It doesn't matter that the physical exam wasn't adequate in the DEA's opinion to the care being given. Primary care doctors aren't going to do what the pain specialist does. So a patient comes to you having been scanned multiple times, having huge workups by specialists, you're going to check the general stuff, the heart, the lungs, the liver, all this stuff. You're not going to try to reproduce everything the pain specialist did. But the pain specialist will, or at least one of them, will get paid to get up there and say, you should have. Now, since when does the DEA get to be the arbiter of what is and what is not an adequate physical exam? The state, the medical board rules say adequate to the purpose of the visit, right? And if you're a primary care doctor, you're seeing someone as a PCP, you're worried about their overall health. If you're a pain specialist and a colleague has already worked this person up every way from Sunday, then you know what's going on and you just confirm it. You do a few things to confirm, see if something doesn't match. Another thing that comes up is they'll say, well, you didn't order any objective tests, right? Most of these people have already been imaged so thoroughly that you can see their descendants. It's not, well, what are you going to do? Order an MRI every time a new patient comes in just so you can say, look, I ordered one, even if they had one just a few months ago? Now, of course, the OIG is going to be looking at you for fraud because you're ordering unnecessary tests. It is a catch-22. It is an impossible standard to the point that any doctor, you bring me any doctor today that prescribe any controlled medication and let me climb through their chart, and I will find an excuse to prosecute them according to the DEA's rules, yeah. Right? So the DEA will say if they traveled a long distance to see you, that's indicative of abuse and addiction and diversion, even with specialists. That is ridiculous when it comes to specialists. Because specialists are spread out. First off, where I'm at, we're an hour from anywhere. We're 4 hours from like Fort Smith, 2 hours from Little Rock, 3 hours from Dallas, and about 1 to 1.5 hours to Shreveport. So you're going to be driving more than 50 miles to find any specialist,
yeah,
if they don't happen to be in this town. And they were, pain specialists have been leaving in droves. We had 2 pain clinics shut down. And they sent their patients to our clinic. So we have a choice. turn these patients away, which is what most doctors are doing. Right now, if you're a pain patient, I have tremendous pity for you because you will find no one willing to help you. And if they accept you as a patient, they're going to stop everything that worked before and put you on something that does not work because that's safe for them. When I say does not work, a lot of people say, well, you know, these studies show that NSAIDs work just as well as opiates for minor surgeries, for 3 or 4 days post minor surgery, right? That's not chronic pain. People with neurogenic pain, it can feel like their leg or their arm is on fire. If you've got something better to use, let us know. Because when you try to use ketamine, you get targeted also. You get local law enforcement officers saying, isn't that a horse tranquilizer? And you get the DEA running around gathering up every prescription because they think it's a party drug. They don't realize that it can increase synaptoplasticity and neuroplasticity. It can kind of reset those second and third order neurons that are malfunctioning and just continuously sending a pain signal. So you're trying, but I heard that at Harvard, by the way. I go all the way to Harvard. I learn these things. I come back. Every doctor that learns something new and brings it back to their rural area of practice is no longer in the average practice of medicine, right? So by that definition, they can just be arrested. Average and usual, the usual practice of medicine must be defined in a way that gives physicians the freedom to care for their patients. And a legitimate medical purpose comes down to two questions. Did the patient have a condition? Did the doctor believe the patient had a condition? Because sometimes they'll lie to you. And did he prescribe a medication approved for that condition? So if someone comes in and says, I have severe chronic pain, and their records support that, and you prescribe something for severe chronic pain, nothing else should matter. That's a legitimate prescription if you believe the patient had that. Now, what they'll do is they will get an undercover officer to come in, and they will fake medical records, and they will lie to you. And they will say they're in pain. And then sometimes they'll record. Recordings will suddenly appear if you didn't lay hands on every inch of them. If you did lay hands on every inch of them, recordings strangely weren't done or aren't available. All right. So I had an undercover agent come into my clinic. First, he applied to be a patient, and we rejected him. I have the little rejection note I sent. I said, I don't see any prior records, nothing like that. We won't evaluate a patient for chronic pain without those. So then they created fake records and sent them to me.
Wow.
I reviewed them and I said, okay, give him an appointment. And when he came to see me, I did a full exam, back exam, everything where he said it hurt. I looked everything over and I sat him down and said, these records and your exam and symptoms don't warrant prescribing controlled medications. I said, I'm going to put you on something else, and I think that'll be better for you in the long run. Amazingly, that recording was not available to me, though there is a report, a little brief, you know, and we didn't get anything. It is, and that goes to the use of informants and disgruntled employees, angry patients that you had to fire. Oh, my gosh. They will wait till you fire a patient. And they get busted maybe 2 months later for prescribing oxycodone or something. They will say anything to protect themselves from that lengthy sentence they're looking at.
Yeah.
Right? So it's a mess.
Your story is incredibly tragic. And the way you articulate it just compounds the injustice. What's very unique is how little media coverage and how quickly a physician's credibility can be taken. From your perspective, looking at your history with the military, your history with the legal system, and your practice, what is it that's giving this narrative perpetuated by the DEA so much power?
It's a bad time to be a doctor right now. A lot of popular media, I'm talking about Netflix, it started with Dope Sick, which was not a bad movie and not terribly inaccurate. right? The only inaccurate thing about dope sick is when these poor U.S. attorneys are trying to talk to, you know, the drug reps. The drug reps are telling them, you know, go to heck, we don't have to listen to you. Nobody, U.S. attorneys have absolute immunity and absolute authority. They can arrest and do anything they want, and there's no oversight. You don't get to question anything they did. No one does. They would have to choose to prosecute themselves if they broke the law. I've seen one break the law, clearly. Practiced for 12 years without a law license. Was hired without a law license, practiced without a law license, lied about it for 12 years, and was not prosecuted because her office said, we're going to decline to prosecute. Every citizen in America would love to have the ability to decline to prosecute themselves, but we don't. They do. So Dope Sick made a mistake there. But otherwise, it was a good movie, and I enjoyed it. Then you've got ones like Painkiller, which make every doctor look like he's just out there partying and going to the Bahamas. I must have missed the entire era. I never got to go anywhere. Nobody gave me big bucks. Nothing. And doing the right thing in that regard doesn't save you either.
No.
I wouldn't let drug reps come into my office. They could talk to my staff and leave brochures. Why? Because I thought, probably, there is some unconscious biasing that takes place. Otherwise, they wouldn't spend the money on having a drug rep there. So I say, I'll read your literature. I'll look at the studies. I don't want to speak to you directly. You got an MD, we'll do it. But, you know, if you're just a salesman, I'm not going to listen, because I think the studies are too often, you know, they select the studies and all that. So that won't save you. That doesn't matter one bit when you get targeted. So right now it is bad to be a doctor because the popular media says doctors are greedy. They make way too much money and they just don't care about their patients, willing to kill them for a few bucks. Then the opioid crisis hit. Now, the opioid crisis is a continuation of America's war on drugs. 70 years and $2.7 trillion later, things are worse than they've ever been. So what must we do? We must continue to do what we've been doing, just harder, right? That's the DEA's solution. The military is more flexible than the DEA, right? If my tactic has failed over a 70-year period of time, heck, if my tactic fails twice, I'm switching to something else. But for the DEA, the dramatic number of deaths means they don't have enough money, right? But they've got to do something to justify that people must go to prison. And it's very hard to actually go get the Sinaloa cartel guys. They object to being gotten, and they'll shoot back at you. Doctors are a breeze, right? They came into my office kicking the doors open with machine guns. There's a big sign on my front door, no firearms allowed. So why are they pointing machine guns at my patients in wheelchairs? Because they can, because it's really good media, and they had the media there, and it looks great, and it looks like they're doing something. And they are doing something. They are terrifying doctors in America. They are no longer treating pain. These pain patients can't tolerate the amount of suffering they're going through. They're going to the street. They're buying fake pills. Those pills are laced with fentanyl. And they're dying in record numbers. And it is a direct result of the DEA preventing doctors from treating pain and addiction. Because they're targeting the addiction doctors now, too.
Yeah.
You know, they say, you know, buprenorphine is one of the most diverted medications. Yes. It is, because people have trouble suffering from withdrawals. The question is, does it kill anyone? The answer is no. No. So if it was made more readily available, then you wouldn't have these problems. Now, the difficulty I have is that you have all these opioid settlements. Where does that money go?
Yeah.
Do we see free buprenorphine being prescribed to people with opiate use disorder? No. No, you don't. It still costs a fortune. And the best medicine, I think, for buprenorphine, the patches would be good. You can't use that for addiction. That's only for pain. That's fine for pain. But the sub-Q injections that last an entire month,
yeah,
those things are incredible. I was the first in my area to start using those. No diversion. They don't have to take pills. They don't have to carry bottles around to their job. If they go a few days long, it has a tapering effect for the next 2 weeks. That's a beautiful medication, but it is outrageously expensive. And the opioid settlements don't pay any of that. Yeah. So if you wanted to study how to mess things up, you could not have had a better formula than the DEA has been using over the last about 7 years.
Yeah, it's incredible how articulate you are about this and almost how reckless government policy has been, yet there's this kind of willful blindness. As you had mentioned with the opioid settlement money, I think it's only around 80% has to be allocated towards addiction and potential redresses for inappropriate opioids. And it's very interesting to see how these decisions are being made. Some of the policies that seem to be contradicting the DEA. So for example, methadone is now more readily available as per a physician's discretion toward a patient. Certain medications like naltrexone are available without a prescription. These changes would seem to indicate that harm reduction, trusting the patient, making a clinical decision despite the risk of diversion, is the clinically sound approach. Yet legally, as you and I can both attest to, that's not the DEA stance. So what is the explanation for this contradiction?
You've got a battle between two federal agencies. The Department of Health and Human Services, which according to the United States Supreme Court is the only part of the federal government with the right to make medical suggestions. In Gonzalez versus Oregon, the U.S. Supreme Court clearly said the DEA has no place dictating the practice of medicine. Now, they might not have the right, but they clearly have the power. So you've got these two federal agencies. You've got one that is evidence and science-based and one that is politically based. Now, politicians will push things toward non-medical treatment because all you need is what they think, right? All you need is to go cold turkey and then you need to tough it out. And if you don't suffer, you won't remember. And I don't know how many times I've heard that. And using buprenorphine or methadone is just trading one addiction for another. And I try to explain, no, you're trading an addiction for a treatment. Those are not the same thing, right? And so you've got these two groups battling it out. Law enforcement is on the side of being harsh, right? And they're the ones with the power to come get you. So the DEA is part of that. The side, like a lot of the national groups, physicians groups, I hate to say it, but physicians are some of the biggest cowards I've ever seen in my life. Physicians whose careers I helped establish. I would say, can you come speak for me? I was helping you with your cancer patients. Oh, I'm afraid I'll be targeted. And you can hear the fear in their voice.
Yeah.
That's when you know that, I mean, you're approaching, I hate to say it, but you're approaching police state status when people are afraid to tell the truth because they're afraid they'll be targeted. No physician in America should be afraid to voice their opinion because they're afraid they'll be targeted. But physicians have been targeted. A lot of defense experts have been targeted. A lot of addiction experts have been targeted. And I'm even afraid to say their name here because they're so scared of their names going out there that I'm afraid I'll be betraying them. I feel like it's East Germany and, you know, the Stasi's out there. And, you know, every third person in East Germany was an informant. About 33% of the nation was informing on the other 66%. So, I feel like we're approaching that.
Let's talk a little bit about the nature of fear in healthcare because it's something that's grown quite pervasive in recent years. Before the pandemic, and really, I mean, going back 5-10 years, there might have been one or two hot button health issues. Abortion is what normally comes to top of mind.
Yes.
But now it seems that every healthcare issue has some semblance of political polarization. During the pandemic, providing a unique perspective on vaccines or the origins of COVID-19 would land you in that proverbial hot seat. And again, you'd be lambasted. And what we're coming to find out now was drastically different than what we were told to believe
right
back then. So Do you see parallels in this culture of fear around healthcare in America and how it affects different issues from COVID-19, opioids, and other polarizing health issues?
Politicians have found the power of politicizing healthcare. You see it with transgender care, you see it with abortion, and now you see it with pain treatment and addiction treatment. These things had been left to the scientists and the physicians. And in the past, if you had tried to delve into that area, your colleagues would smack you back saying, you know, wait a minute, you don't know that area, right? Let the experts decide. And I have mixed feelings on this because let's look at the pandemic, right? Here in the state that I reside, a physician treated all the prisoners in one prison with ivermectin to keep them from getting COVID. Now, would I have done that? No, because I didn't see studies that convinced me that ivermectin was going to work. Should he have been locked up for it? Heck no, because nobody knew what would work. Now, the medical board can tell him, hey, stop it, don't do that again. But we don't need politicians coming out and saying, you absolutely should give ivermectin, give it to everybody. Or another one coming out and say, if you give it to somebody, we'll lock you up, which is what they're trying to do. They're trying to criminalize the second opinion. So what do they do when they put you on trial? They get an expert, medical expert. Now, you're a doctor. You're a physician. All physicians are expert in prescribing medications. That's the one thing that we can do, right? Nurse practitioners and such. But still, the court will tell the jury that you are not an expert. And you're saying, why not? When did that happen? Well, as soon as you were charged. Yeah. The government expert will be an expert, and you can hire an expert if you can find one to come in for you. And but you yourself cannot be considered an expert by the jury. And so then you're up there defending your medical practice from a tarnished point of view already, from a false point of view already, because you are an expert. You got your medical degree. You spent 4 years. People will be certified as experts because they have mail order degrees, have never been to school, and have studied something for 6 months. I've seen courts do that. So how can someone who has spent 4 years in medical school, plus time in their internship or residency, plus all their years of practice, how can they not be an expert? Of course they're an expert, but you're not considered an expert. And it has become popular. It's always fine to question anything. It's not fine to give your opinion the weight of law. So when you go to court, two doctors have two different opinions on what a patient needed. And the jury gets to decide if you go to prison for holding an opinion different than the one person they found. Now, they will say that one person reflects the national standard of practice, right? The national practice of medicine, they say. There is no national practice of medicine. There is no national medical license. As a matter of fact, in Oregon, Oregon versus Gonzalez came about because Oregon said, you know, if somebody is dying a horrible death and suffering terribly, and you get two specialists in that area of medicine to say they don't have a hope, and you get two psychiatrists to say they're of a sound mind, a physician may prescribe a narcotic medication, a controlled medication, for the purpose of ending that person's life in accordance with that person's wishes, if that's what they want. So euthanasia under very strict conditions. The DEA said, nope, we will prosecute you. Any doctor that does that, we will prosecute because that's not a legitimate use of a controlled medication. Well, the doctor sued, and the Supreme Court slapped the DEA down, said you can't dictate the practice of medicine. Then what are they doing now? They are dictating the practice of medicine. And even though Ruan slapped them down, they left a huge gaping loophole, which is called willful ignorance or willfully blind. So you have to have criminal intent unless you were willfully blind. Willfully blind to a crime? No. Willfully blind to whatever we convince the jury you should have done. So their expert will get up there and say, In my case, MRIs are not objective. MRIs are objective according to the Arkansas State Medical Board, the Medical Practices Act. according to every textbook I've ever read and every reasonable physician and scientist. But he said they weren't, right? So I'm up there. Well, when it's my turn to talk, I'm like an auctioneer trying to address all these issues. They are objective. Okay, 50-50. Tie goes to the government, right? Tie goes to the runner in baseball. Tie goes to the government in this case. That guy's an expert, right? He said they weren't objective. He said that the EMGs I had done were read wrong. The expert had read them wrong. He said that the VA doctors had made a mistake to start treatment on a veteran for chronic pain. He says spinal fractures should have healed by now, and he could tell by the MRIs the guy didn't have that much pain. Well, no, you can't. The textbook clearly says you cannot tell from an MRI how much pain someone has.
But I want to pause you right there because I think that's a very important point. A federal witness, a government witness, who we assume was a physician,
yes,
went in a trial under oath stating that he or she could determine pain, a subjective assessment based off of just looking at an imaging study.
He could tell by looking at the imaging study not only that it had been misread by the previous radiologist, misinterpreted by the previous pain specialist, but that he could tell that the patient didn't have that much pain. Now, you and I immediately push back and say, okay, now you've really gone too far, because we know the textbook. I've got it right over here, Principles and Practice of Pain Medicine. I think it's chapter 72. Anyway, clearly says you can't do that. Everyone knows you can't do that. No, everyone doesn't know. You and I know because we're physicians, but the jury doesn't know. So the jury sits there nodding her head, you know, their heads, you know, well, The expert said he could tell by looking at the MRI that the guy didn't have that much pain. You don't get to stand up and yell, that's not true. Now, I took the stand in my defense, and I did the best I could, but the lawyers, they don't even know what questions to ask. They don't know that that was a completely off-the-rails, you know, statement. They don't recognize that. They don't know that. Now, part of it comes down to whether or not you can afford a healthcare specialty defense, because it's... Hiring a regular lawyer, any physician who hires a regular lawyer on one of these trials is hiring a dermatologist to treat a brain tumor. You better get that neurosurgeon. You better get a healthcare specialty law firm, and they better have a track record of fighting and winning when physicians are brought to trial on the Controlled Substances Act. Otherwise, they are just as clueless as the jury. And not only that, they're prone to believing the prosecution. The prosecution witness will say this, and they'll say, well, the expert says that you shouldn't do this. First, that's his opinion. It's no more valid than mine. Secondly, that's not in the textbooks. That's not the defined limits of medicine. When the Supreme Court was arguing Ruan, one of the Supreme Court justices said, well, what's the speed limit? How much medicine can a doctor prescribe a patient? And all the lawyers had to admit, well, there's not one. The speed limit is basically drive at a safe speed. And you won't know what that safe speed is until we come and arrest you. And it's up to each individual officer. So you might be going 45 and one officer pulls you over and says, hey, that's too fast. You should be going 40. Another one will let you go 65. It just all depends. So good luck.
Yeah, that was actually Chief Justice John Roberts, and I distinctly remember that transcript and just shaking my head to think, these are the highest jurists in the land, and they're creating comparables to speed limits?
Exactly. And they see the CDC's guidelines as a speed limit. Many states did. And I really have a lot of anger at the state medical boards for not standing up and telling the politicians, don't do this. Don't codify this into law. That in our state, you can't prescribe more than... Colorado just went the other way. I don't know if you've been keeping up with Colorado, but Colorado just passed an act that will let their doctors safely treat pain, right? No, absolutely not. The Arkansas Medical Practices Act says that a doctor in the state of Arkansas cannot be criminally prosecuted, even if they use dangerous medications in dangerous combinations, even if the patient dies, unless it can be proven to be the doctor's intent to kill the patient. You cannot be criminally prosecuted. The government doesn't care about that. No. They don't care about state laws. So Colorado's laws do nothing to protect doctors in the state of Colorado except give them a false sense of security. where they believe that they can practice according to their education, training, and experience, when in reality, they're in more danger. I'd rather be in a state that said, don't prescribe any controlled medicines at all, and I say, okay. Because then...
they're being transparent.
Yeah, absolutely. We're not supposed to have mystery laws in this country, right? Mm-hmm. The laws are supposed to be clear, and you're supposed to know what you can and cannot do. We are taught, and the DEA will say, I've heard them lecture to medical societies, you know, if you're a good doctor trying to help your patients, we won't come after you. It's only those who are clearly not trying to be doctors. That is an absolute lie. If they get a patient willing to lie about you, if they get a former employee, and that is gold for them, if they get a former employee willing to lie about you, you are toast, and you almost certainly will be prosecuted because it's so easy for them.
Yes.
Someone's going to get up, and to protect themselves from a lengthy sentence or just to get revenge, they're going to say, well, you know, he really didn't care about the patients. And they could not find a single patient to say bad things about him. And that's not because I'm a saint. That's because I care about my patients. I talk to them. I spend time with them. I love being a doctor. I love helping people and healing people. But I can tell you right now that the practice of medicine in the United States of America is not worth it. I had a niece that was going to go to medical school. I strongly suggested she do something else. It is not safe. Wow. It is not worth it. There are so many more ways to make a good living where you are not under this impossible scrutiny. Doctors in Idaho today have to decide when a woman comes in pregnant and needs, you know, termination of the pregnancy. It's a non-viable pregnancy. It's an ectopic pregnancy, whatever. They can be criminally prosecuted. The courts just ruled that it's okay to criminally prosecute them because they said, well, they'll get to argue it in court. You and I know that when you make it to court, you're done, right? Yeah. A whole DOA. Life. You're dead. You get reincarnated as whatever survives court, and you rebuild your life and you start over.
Yeah.
Because it takes everything away from you.
Certainly. It's very difficult to explain this to the public if they're not intimately aware or at least willing to look behind the narratives being perpetuated. In your experience, writing, advocating, and just relaying the message about the discrimination against physicians' own autonomy and decision-making, what arguments work? What is an effective strategy to at least get the public to say, hey, think twice about what you're seeing on the news?
When you ask them, okay, I'm an ER doctor, right? When you get shot and come in, right, I'm going to call the DEA and say, what do you think this person should have? Is it okay to give them morphine? He might have a history of selling medicines. He might have a history of addiction. Is it okay if I give him something? Well, I'll wait while you look it up. And you tell the guy there that's been shot through the thigh, hey, it's going to hurt for a little bit. I know the bone's fractured, but I'm going to wait. That's what you would have to do. You can't do that and be a conscionable, you know, physician. And you can't even, it is not safe to do the right thing. And that's when you know things have gone way too far. A good example of that is Dr. Terry Sasaki from, born and raised in Hawaii, was in New York. He became aware that he started reviewing charts for this company, right? And he gave them his information. Well, he became aware that they were prescribing narcotics in his name. He went to the DEA and spoke to them and informed them about what was going on. 2 years later, he gets rolled into the prosecution with a DEA agent saying, he confessed to me when he was speaking to me. All the other DEA agents say, well, I don't remember that conversation. We don't have any notes about it. But hey, Fred says he did it. That's all it took. That's all it took to ruin that young doctor's life. This is even, gosh, I hate to say it, but even the witches at Salem had to have two witnesses, right? One witness was not enough. They had to be two before they would hang you for being a witch.
Yeah.
It's a tragedy, not just for Dr. Sasaki, but for the entire nation. Yeah. Our country doesn't have enough physicians, and we're losing young, brilliant physicians to this stupidity just so they can get a conviction, just so they can you know, mount something on their wall. And the innocent are much easier to convict than the guilty. The guilty, they take plans to hide what they're doing, right? The innocent don't hide anything because they have nothing to hide, and they think being innocent will protect them. But if someone is willing to lie about you, you can go away. And the people who are prosecuting people, they justify it because the ends justify the means. They have to sacrifice a few for the many. They never sacrifice themselves. It's always someone else. But that's, you know, that's like the old saying, you know, suffering is good for the soul. No one on fire ever said suffering is good for the soul. It's always said by the person watching somebody on fire, right?
So, exactly.
You know, these things are tragic, and they're costing our nation tremendously. And right now is a very dark time to be practicing medicine in America.
Dr. Parker, thank you so much for sharing your story and for your insights. You also have your own YouTube channel and your own online presence as well. For those who are listening and would like to learn more about your work, can you highlight your YouTube channel and where people can find some of your writings?
Sure. The channel I've started is the Center for Medical Justice, and that's where I focus on people who die in prisons and jails from medical neglect. Okay, and I've written a lot of articles that are being published. There was one in the Journal of Medicine about the persecution of pain doctors, and I've written several others, and I've written for the Daily Remedy, and it's very important that these stories get out. I know it puts a target on our back, but there's a target on all our backs, and those who don't realize it, they're in the greatest danger of going away.
Agreed. And with that, Dr. Parker, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, sir. You have a good day.